Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We've been told that human smugglers operating on the U.S. southern border are trafficking in human misery, that they illegally bring people into the United States while robbing, extorting, raping, sometimes murdering them, and that the situation is so bad now that Texas has been spending billions of dollars for Operation Lone Star. And now President Donald Trump is declaring the southern border a national emergency and that he will use the U.S. military to repel what he calls an invasion force. The depiction of smuggling is at odds, though, with what we see in Jason De Leon's book, Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. The book is recognized with a National Book Award for Nonfiction last year. Jason De Leon, welcome to The Source. And Jason, can you hear me? Okay, while we work that out, Jason De Leon is a professor of anthropology and Chicano studies, the director of the Kosten Institute of Archaeology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is also the executive director of the Undocumented Migrant Project, and he is also a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. His previous book was The Land of Open Graves, Living and Dying on the Migrant Trail. This is something that I've also have reported on in here at Texas Public Radio. I've spent time in South Texas, particularly in Brooks County, looking into how migrants die trying to cross the desert in South Texas. Eddie Canales, who's a human rights advocate who we lost last year, I worked with him to build water stations in South Texas to help migrants survive that dangerous trek. Yet every year we hear of thousands of migrants who do die trying to cross the border and then trying to cross that desert. The issue is that we have a Border Patrol checkpoint in Falfurrias, which is strategically placed in order to funnel people who want to avoid detection by the Border Patrol to start walking around the station, around that area, into the desert. And the ground is particularly difficult to navigate because it's a sandy type of soil. It's not even really a soil because it's not really conducive to growing anything. And people frequently lose their lives. I remember one time I did a story on a Texas story about a boy named his name was Christian Gonzalez, and he was a dreamer. And he was living with his family in Palestine, Texas, out in East Texas. And he had been given DACA protection because of he was a dreamer, and that he was living with his family in East Texas, and he had graduated high school, and he was getting ready to go into the workforce when the ICE turned up at his doorstep and said that he was being deported. Being deported because apparently he had committed a crime at one point, and that crime was that he accidentally shot a next-door neighbor with a BB gun. And the next-door neighbors filed a report saying that that was assault. He never went to a court over that. He let it go, and he didn't fight it, and therefore he was convicted for that crime, and then he was deported. Christian Gonzalez didn't speak any Spanish hardly at all. He had never really had any memories of living in Mexico, and yet he was deported into Mexico, and then he tried to come back into the United States. He contracted his parents with helped him with a human smuggler, and then on his way back into the United States, he died in that desert. I'm told now we're now joined by Jason De Leon, and Jason, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right, and so the story I was telling about was about this young man. He dies in the desert in South Texas trying to cross back in and his family didn't know what happened to him. They had no idea until there was a online repository of remains. They recognized something that he was carrying, and they were able to bring his remains back home and have him buried in Palestine, Texas. But this is not that unusual of a story, is it? Many, many people die trying to cross into the United States, and that is one of the things that you have researched.
That's correct. Yes, both through Texas, through Arizona, and California, now increasingly New Mexico.
Yeah, so Jason, your latest book, Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling, you hang out with these smugglers. How did you come to do that?
You know, I got to know a group of smugglers in southern Mexico in the state of Chiapas starting around 2015. And, you know, I just became very interested in the role that smugglers play because, I mean, you can't have undocumented migration without smugglers for the most part. And I feel like they are the kind of elephant in the room in this giant global process. But you really only hear about them when something bad happens. And, you know, and obviously those are tragedies and brutal kinds of things. But I would say that the majority of the time, you know, migrants are looking at smugglers as people who are providing services. And so, you know, I would say the bulk of the labor that happens actually, you know, gets people from point A to, you know, to wherever it is that they're trying to get to. And so I really wanted to understand this important role that they play that we just don't seem to know much about.
Well, what we do know about frequently comes from law enforcement or from politicians who are trying to tell us how bad things are. How reliable are those stories?
You know, I mean, obviously people die migrating, and oftentimes smugglers are implicated in these things. But, you know, for politicians, I mean, this is like these are these easy scapegoats. And talking about the evils of smuggling really then is, for me, a sleight of hand so that people don't have to talk about why they're actually migrating. You know, I think about smugglers as a symptom of much larger problems, but it's way easier to kind of demonize them and to shift attention away from global political issues, economic issues, by really honing in on these individuals who, for me, are just part of a much bigger problem.
And so the smugglers, we frequently hear them, they're human traffickers is the other thing that we hear about them. What's the difference between smuggling and trafficking?
Yeah, that is an enormous problem that people don't seem to understand the difference between. I mean, people who are trafficked have that happen against their will. And so, you know, they are forced to go someplace else, oftentimes sold into slavery and other things. People who are smuggled, they are paying those smugglers to get them where they want to go. That does not mean that you can't contract a smuggler and they don't end up trafficking you, which does happen. But for the most part, people who enter into an economic agreement with a smuggler, they are paying them for a service to get them to where they want to go. But politicians are oftentimes very quick to conflate those two things, because trafficking has all of these terrible connotations. But, you know, smuggling is a radically different kind of thing that we need to understand.
We're going to take a break here. We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion with Jason De Leon. He is a professor of anthropology, archaeology. He is also has been an archaeologist. He's the executive director of the Undocumented Migration Project. And his latest book is Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. Our phone lines are open. We want to hear your calls, your questions. You know, what's your take on all this? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR Talk. The Source continues right after this.
The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/edd/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. David, we're joined by Jason De Leon. He is the author of the book Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. We're talking about this topic in context to what we're hearing from new President Donald Trump calling for, he has declared the southern border a national emergency. He will be moving troops down there. And we have militarized the Texas-Mexico border, at least in some spots, in trying to repel smuggling and declaring that this is something that is a existential threat to the United States. Jason De Leon has lived with and studied and had contact with human smugglers. So, Jason De Leon, are the smugglers that you know, are they trying to overthrow the United States?
No, the smugglers that I know are part of this larger system that profits from both the desperation of migrants and Americans' need for cheap, expendable labor. The picture that's painted of smugglers is like this highly organized, sort of kingpin-esque kind of system. I mean, these are oftentimes destitute migrants themselves, people who realize they can make a quick buck by helping people, sneak across a geopolitical boundary. But they are really providing a service both, I would say, for migrants, for American consumers, for American business people. And we talk about this emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border. The emergency that we have is climate change. It's driving these people from their home countries. That's being driven by countries like the United States. And then also the fact that, you know, the emergency is this the need that American companies have for cheap labor. And so this is, I mean, the U.S.-Mexico border is a smokescreen for these much bigger issues. And, you know, declaring a state of emergency there is a way to look tough on this immigration issue that really is not, the problem is not at the U.S.-Mexico border. The problem is in Honduras. The problem is in factories in Iowa. The problem is much, much bigger than the way that it's been framed both by Trump and by many others before him.
So I've been to bus stations in Mexico and seeing on the wall flyers that are pinned up saying that if you can get across and you can get to this town or whatever, we have work for you. If you want to work at a poultry farm place, you know, we can give you work. These are American companies who are basically soliciting people to come across, to come to the United States and work.
Yeah, I mean, if Donald Trump really wanted to get tough on immigration, they would police the workforce. And what you're going to see is there are going to be some highly publicized raids happening in the next probably couple of weeks. People are going to get arrested and deported, and then that's going to stop. And then we're going to go back to business as normal because, if we really wanted to be tough on immigration and wanted people to stop coming, we would be policing farms across the United States. We'd be policing factories across the United States. But if we were to do that, it would crash the American economy quickly. And so you're not going to see any of those things happen. You're going to see these publicity stunts that will brutalize and change people's lives for the worst, and then it'll go away. This idea that immigration is a problem to be solved at the U.S.-Mexico border is a farce, but it's one that politically has worked for a very long time, unfortunately.
I've read the statistic that in Texas, 1 out of 10 workers is likely undocumented. In the industries of construction, it's 4 out of 10. And in agriculture, it's at least 6 out of 10. So if you were to remove those people from the workforce, what would happen?
Yeah, I mean, things will come to a screeching halt. I mean, Americans don't want to pay $25 for a pound of tomatoes. They don't want to see construction costs go through the roof where it gets to the point where nobody can afford to build anything. And so we have this double standard where there's a certain segment of the American public that hates migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border and then benefits from their labor on a daily basis in their home communities, completely ignores them when they're doing the work that American citizens don't want to do. And for me, that's always been the hypocrisy of this conversation, is that it's like we're telling folks, if you can get across the U.S.-Mexico border and not die, then we will ignore you and allow you to work under the table in the shadows and contribute to our economy, and we won't say anything about it. We'll just continue to kind of to benefit from it.
Let's listen to some callers. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Brenda, you're on the line with Jason De Leon.
Thank you for taking my call. You had mentioned that you had done research, but my question is, how did you verify your research in counting the number of migrants that have died when they crossed the border? Do you get that number from GPS? I mean, how is that verified?
All right, Brenda, thank you for that. So, Jason, do you we have good numbers about the numbers of deaths who cross over?
We know, unfortunately, we don't. And so my first book, The Land of Open Graves, really looked at migrants who die crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, specifically through Arizona. One of the things that I argue in that book is that the number of recovered remains that we have probably grossly underestimates the actual number of people who die while crossing. The people die in the middle of nowhere. They die in places where body recovery is virtually impossible to do. But also the elements, you know, scavenging animals like vultures and just the environmental conditions quickly destroy bodies. And so we did forensic experiments in that work to show how quickly a body could potentially disappear. And so, you know, the numbers that we have, they come from law enforcement, they come, from the Border Patrol. But, from my perspective, you could likely double or triple those number, those fatalities and have a more accurate count. But just people die in places where you're never going to find them. And that's by design. I mean, migrants cross the U.S.-Mexico border increasingly through remote areas because the Border Patrol is trying to use the natural environment as an impediment to movement. And that's why people need to contract smugglers, because they need someone to guide them through the deserts and through the woods. But unfortunately, a lot of people succumb to the elements during that process.
So Kate Spradley, who is a forensic anthropologist at Texas State University, and she's the director of Operation ID, which go out into the South Texas desert and they collect remains, and they're trying to inform the families of these people that they died in the desert. And they have an online repository of what they find. And I went into the vault that she has at Texas State University in San Marcos, and it was astonishing how huge it was of the remains of the people who died in the desert. And and these are just a few that they're able to recover, but the animals quickly will descend upon the bodies as they fall, and it's not long before there is really nothing left.
That's correct. I mean, we did the first formal forensic experiments in Arizona on migrant death and decomposition starting around 2012, and some of the results from those experiments were that, you know, a body could go from fully fleshed to completely skeletonized and scattered hundreds of feet within less than, 3 to 5 days.
Right, and you used a pig carcass for that. You dressed them up in the clothing of a migrant and also gave them identification, all this to see what would remain, and pretty much it was all just gone. At Texas State University in San Marcos, they have the thing called the Body Ranch, where they do leave out human remains for people who have donated their bodies for these types of experiments, and they have the same finding. It's gripping. Let's go to another caller. Enrique, is it Robert? And Robert, you're on the air. Robert, go ahead.
I was wondering, the smugglers are not a charitable organization, and they are recklessly endangering these people's lives, almost committing a crime. How much do they make for doing that? How profitable is the business?
Robert, thank you for the call.
You know, it's not that profitable. I mean, at least for the folks who are doing the kind of on-the-ground sort of work. It comes out to probably less than minimum wage. But it's definitely a sort of boom or bust industry. Something to think about, there are the people who broker the deal, who are kind of at the upper level. They take the big money, and then they pay these underlings to move people through the jungles, through the train tracks, and all these other places. And so the folks who are actually moving folks on the ground tend to not make very much money. But that being said, you know, keep in mind that migrants are working very, very hard to find smugglers that are relatively trustworthy. And so historically, if you were migrating from Mexico, you would go to the local coyote in your village, someone who had social connections to your family, to your community, and you would broker a deal with them in hopes that if something happened to you, you at least knew whose door to go kind of knocking on. But the way in which the system has changed over and it's really ramped up, I mean, now, it's increasingly difficult for, you know, the mom and pop industry that once existed really has kind of gone the way of the dinosaur. And, you know, transnational gangs now, MS-13, Mexican drug cartels, all of these folks now have a hand in this industry, which has just made it, more and more brutal. But, the thing I would also say is that, this is an exploitative service industry, but it's also it's catering to a need. And so I think we think about it as like, oh, well, these smugglers are putting people in harm's way and they're exploiting them. Well, they're being exploited by workers. They're being exploited by all kinds of other folks as well. And, you know, it's part of this much bigger system. And I would say, too, that like smugglers, people are not dying in the Arizona desert or in the South Texas backwoods because smugglers like hiking through those areas. They are those areas because of border enforcement systems that are designed to funnel people towards those places. And so, you know, we can't simply blame the smuggler for migrant deaths in Texas or in Arizona. We have to think about, you know, there's a Border Patrol policy called Prevention Through Deterrence that has been in place since the early 90s that has purposely used the natural environment as a deterrent, and that has killed thousands of people. And so, you know, the Border Patrol likes to kind of put all the blame onto the smuggler, but their hands are dirty, and they have been implicated in these migrant deaths since, you know, since the early 1990s, if not earlier.
But, you know, we have heard from migrants who've made the journey, and they tell their stories, that along the way, the smuggler will tell them, the coyote will tell them, oh, now you know, you owe me now another extra $500,000, $2,000. And if you don't have the money, you need to call your family members and tell them that you need to come up with that money. And if they don't, they will torture or even kill the person that's being smuggled.
Yeah, I mean, and like people's experiences with these folks, I mean, it can run the full range of, I paid this person what we agreed upon and they got me to where I was going to go. I paid this person what we agreed upon and they nickel and dimed me the entire way, but I still got to where I was going to go. Or I paid this person what I promised him, and then they kidnapped me and tortured me and did all this other kind of horrible stuff. I mean, it's a full spectrum of experiences. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how, you know, smugglers themselves, they sort of talk about, you know, who's a good smuggler, who's a bad smuggler, the kind of the range of services that one can provide or can expect. But yeah, I mean, it's a hit or miss industry, and migrants are working very, very hard to find the best kind of person for that job. But, you know, it's oftentimes a real crapshoot. And one of the things that surprised me working on with smugglers is that I remember, you know, there's a story I tell in the book about a guy who gets ripped off in the end by a smuggler. He gets him from Honduras all the way to the U.S.-Mexico border and then robs him in northern Mexico. That person ends up getting across eventually. And then later on, that person, same person contacts me and wants contact information for the same smuggler in hopes that they can bring their family, you know, at least that far north. I mean, it's a very, very sketchy industry. And, you know, it's like many of these, like, I think, exploitative capitalist systems, I mean, it's totally unregulated. And people can have, you know, incredibly brutal experiences. But I will say that if everyone just got robbed, if everyone just got kidnapped or worse, then this system would stop functioning. But in fact, it continues to rebuild itself and to keep functioning no matter what.
Because of the desperation of people leaving countries that are not functioning, corruption, violence, and they want to get here where they think their lives will be better. We'll see how things will present themselves with that. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or comment about the life of the smugglers, we're going to hear more about Jason De Leon's actual stories of hanging out with them for 7 years, telling their stories, getting to know them. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about smugglers, the people who operate illegally as bringing humans across the border from Mexico, Central America, South America into South Texas or other parts of the southern U.S. border, and how they do it, why they do it, and what's that look like now that Donald Trump is going to declare. He has declared the southern border a national emergency, and he will be sending the U.S. military there to repel what he calls an invasion force. We're speaking with Jason De Leon. He is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the executive director of the Undocumented Migration Project. He has the book out that was recognized with the National Book Award for Nonfiction last year, and that is a huge deal. Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. And we're taking your calls. You can call in at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Enrique on the phones. Enrique, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My question or comment, I guess, is about goes back to when Ronald Reagan was president. At that time, there was a law passed which provided for amnesty for undocumented who had been here a certain number of years. And another provision of that law was that any employer who hired undocumented workers was to be fined for each unauthorized employee that he had working for him. Now, from my recollection, that law was the part about employer sanctions, if I could recall correctly, was enforced at the beginning of the enactment of that statute. However, after a while, it seemed like it was no longer being enforced. You never, or at least I never heard of any employer being fined or penalized for hiring undocumented workers. So I was wondering what happened. Why did the government stop enforcing those penalties which were required mm-hmm. to be imposed on employers who hired undocumented?
Enrique, thank you for the call. Jason De Leon?
I mean, we stopped enforcing those laws because it's people are losing money, and we don't want to upset those industries. If you police the workforce here, people would, for the most part, stop coming because there's no jobs pulling them here. But we don't want to do that because, like we've been talking about, I mean, it would literally crash our economy. We get tough on this. Is like we're really tough on migrants at the border, but we're not tough on the people who are really fueling this whole system. And, you know, I'll never forget in 2016, I went to a Trump rally in Michigan, and Trump comes out. This is, you know, he's talking to a room full of unemployed auto workers, and he says, "We're going to build this big, beautiful wall. We're going to make Mexico pay for it, and we're going to stop Mexico from stealing your jobs." Mexico is not stealing people's jobs. American factories are putting their factories in the places where they can make the most profit, and that just so happens to be for some of these industries in foreign countries. But these other industries in the United States, it is profitable for them to maintain employing undocumented people because they don't have to pay health insurance. They can pay them lower wages. They can pay them under the table. It's all these things that keep that system in place. And business people and these big industries that have a lot of these politicians in their back pockets, they recognize that, you know, that they have a lot of economic pull, and politicians don't want to mess with them. And so, I mean, this is a fundamental problem, I think, with American capitalism, is that a lot of these industries have these politicians in their back pockets.
So, Jason, you write that people don't grow up wanting to become a smuggler. It's not it's something that people aspire to become. So how do they become smugglers?
You know, smuggling is a brutal industry with it doesn't pay very well, and it's a dangerous occupation with oftentimes a very short lifespan. People end up either dead or in jail, or if they're lucky, they're able to kind of retire and move away. But a lot of folks, you know, they fall into it because, the guys that I ended up writing about were mostly young men from Honduras. They were fleeing violence in Honduras, and so they could no longer stay in their home communities. They didn't really have much of a support network in the United States, and so they found themselves kind of in perpetual motion in Mexico. The fact that they grew up around violence, the fact that they knew the train tracks and these routes meant that they had this knowledge that they could then provide, you know, this service for folks who were leaving Honduras or Central America and trying to get to the United States. And so, a lot of these guys found that these skill sets that they had, they could be violent when necessary against other folks who were maybe, attempting to attack their clients. They were able to broker deals and negotiate with cartels and other criminal organizations. Those were, job skills that they were capitalizing on. Those folks would by the end of the book, everyone that I was writing about did not want to be doing what they were doing. They were all trying to find a way to escape. I didn't really have any other kinds of skills that could you know, that could, that they could be paid for. And so it's this kind of vicious cycle of violence leading to more violence, and then these folks just trying to stay alive as long as possible and make what little money they could with the you know, this kind of specialized skill set that they have.
So yesterday, as Donald Trump was being sworn in, I went to the local, it's called the Migrant Resource Center. It's a place that's providing shelter and assistance to people who are have been found seeking asylum in the United States. And I would talk to some of the young men who were there about what they thought about Trump. And they're from Colombia, and they were young, and they said they like him. They like Trump. And they think that, yeah, he's doing the right thing, sealing the border. That's the best thing for this country. And it had kind of a different kind of view. Than it kind of took me back by surprise. But then I started thinking them about them in the context of your book and about people who have grown up with the violence, the uncertainty, and just the randomness of life that confronts them, that you could lose your life at many different turns. And so they have a different kind of view about what to make of the world, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it gets really complicated when you start asking, you know, some of these questions to folks who, you know, I mean, this also speaks to the fact that you cannot homogenize Latinos. I mean, there's like, you know, this was the problem with Democrats trying to like rally a Latino vote. And the assumption is that because you are Latino, that your number one concern is the border or immigration. And, you know, depending on where you're coming from, you've got different experiences with corruption, with the economy, with borders. And so it doesn't surprise me that you're getting these different kinds of perspectives. But also, I mean, I think we have to keep in mind, too, that, you know, like this idea of like cognitive dissonance, where you're doing this thing you have these opinions that might be flying in the face of what's in your kind of best interest. And, you know, look at who is employed by the U.S. Border Patrol. The Border Patrol is primarily Latinos, Latino men, you know, who are in this industry and who talk about, you know, securing the border, despite the fact that they are themselves immigrants or the children of immigrants, and having this perspective on border enforcement that seems to fly in the face of their own kind of family experiences, you know, or Latino men voting for Trump right now, despite the fact that he's come out and said that, you know, Mexicans are rapists and that the only people who come to this country are the worst of the worst. And yet they're still voting for this person. So, I mean, I think that this speaks to the fact that our understanding of politics and the way the world is complicated and cannot be reduced to just the immigration issue. We have to think about, you know, the economy. We have to think about patriarchy, misogyny, all these other things that shape a person's way of being in the world. But I will say, you know, asking people about Trump, when I was working on this project in 2016, the smugglers that I worked with, they loved Trump. Because they love the bluster in that he says all this crazy inflammatory stuff that's oftentimes, you know, it's pretty meaningless. It's like at the end of the day, it's not going to solve this problem. Trump is not going to secure the border, right? He's going to make a big show of it, and then things are going to go back to normal. Smugglers love him, his megaphone, because they can raise their prices, still knowing, you know, that there's going to be more need for this industry now, and they can charge more money, and not much is going to actually change. You know, we declared an emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border off and on for decades, and you know, what's been proven historically is that border enforcement is no match for human desperation. And currently if people want to be anti-immigrant or secure the border, they need to be thinking about climate change and becoming climate change activists and thinking about all the things that are pushing people from their home countries.
When I first started covering immigration and border security back in the 80s, it used to be that the border was more flexible. It was like a membrane that things could pass in and out pretty easily. And crossing the border was only a few $100s. And, you know, you had local people that knew the back trails and they could get you across. But since we've hardened the border, it's become more industrialized. If you get across, you don't go back to Mexico seasonally. And now the cost is $6,000, $8,000.
Yeah, I mean, post 9/11, you know, we start hardening the border, which now people who are coming back and forth now, I mean, we've created a permanent undocumented population in this country. And, you know, that's not migrants doing that. That is changes in the political wind in the United States. And, you know, people have to keep in mind, too, that especially, you know, I grew up partly in McAllen and Farr. And so when I was a kid in the 80s, I was just accustomed to seeing people coming across the river all day long. And they'd go back in the evening. And it's definitely a different different scenario now. But post 9/11, one of these big sleight of hands is that we start conflating terrorism with immigration. And we start saying, well, if we don't harden the U.S.-Mexico border, migrants or terrorists are going to come across the border, which is not the case. But what that does do is that justifies spending more money for this billion-dollar industry that really does not solve this problem.
Or has no oversight. No one's watching where the money's going. And the numbers are just all over the place. And also we conflate the drug trafficking with illegal immigration, two totally separate things. But we're going to take a break here. I got some callers. I got to get on Adriana and George on the air when we come back from this break. And if you want to get on the air to talk about this, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source with Jason DeLeon returns after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling, who won the National Book Award last year for nonfiction. The author's with us, Jason DeLeon. And let's go to a caller, Adriana. Adriana, you're on the air.
Hi there. I want to congratulate you for your book award. That's really commendable. I wanted to mention that I have a good friend and neighbor, and he used to go across to his home state in Mexico much more frequently as a coyote and also as, I guess, the client of a coyote. And it's increasingly gotten just worse, more dangerous doing that, and obviously more expensive. But he is not the typical bad hombre. He's a property owner and, you know, excellent, you know, tradesmith. And anyway, he did try to get everything done. He paid a immigration lawyer in San Antonio for over $8,000, and just things didn't work out. But he was out the money, and still his legal status is still not good. But he was telling me, you know, you don't know. It is a hard journey. You have to be very physically fit. You've got to have your heart strong, and you can't be, you know, just overweight slob couch potato to get make this journey. And sometimes you're out there longer than you plan, and you have to, you know, have a water source, know where those water sources are, and know where the deer feeders are, because he's had to survive on deer corn. And just, you put it in your mouth, he said, and you just let your saliva soften the deer corn, and you know, that's what you have to eat for a few days while you're making this journey.
Adriana, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate that. And Jason DeLeon, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, people make this assumption that, you know, crossing the border is just the physical act of walking across a, you know, a geopolitical boundary. But, I mean, it can take weeks, months. I mean, and people aren't just coming from Mexico, right? I mean, they are coming from Africa, from South America. And this journey for a lot of them can be months and years. And, you know, people go through a significant amount of hardships all along the way. I mean, it's a very, very brutal process. And that's one of the things I think that I've tried to tell people understand is that, you know, your neighbor, your community members who have gone through this, they have harrowing stories that, you know, that leave lasting impacts on people's lives. And you know, we talk about, you know, Ellis Island and the struggles of immigrants to this country in the early 20th century. And we really romanticize that experience and we demonize and ignore the one that's happening now. But, you know, so many people in this country have gone through these really brutal experiences. And it's unfortunate that we don't really get a chance to really hear those stories from folks directly.
One thing I've noticed is that many times the only thing that people bring with them from home is their Bible. They're carrying a Bible with them. A lot of them are evangelical Christians, and sometimes they're being persecuted in Honduras and other places by the gangs because of their faith.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people are leaving. They're not the worst of the worst are not trying to escape to come, you know, to come to the United States. I mean, these are people who are fleeing these terrible things. You know, these are law-abiding citizens who are literally running for their lives. And I think, you know, we paint this picture of the evil immigrant or the cat eating, or however, you know, whatever.
They're eating the cats. They're pets.
You know, yeah. And it's, you know, these are folks who are trying to do right by their families, who are trying to save their families. And, you know, I think people really need to kind of understand that that's who's coming.
All right. Another caller. Let's go to George. And George, you're on the air.
And I was reading one time about all the violence in Honduras and Panama and Colombia, and they were mentioning a lot of stuff of like the Russian oligarchs and oligarchs from other countries. As an anthropologist, do you see what's going to happen to the United States if we get balkanized and as drug corruption kind of takes over our law enforcement and stuff like that? Won't we collapse, and what'll happen next?
George, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So, Jason De Leon, is there a reason that we need to protect ourselves?
I think we need to protect ourselves from ourselves. I mean, right now, we're watching corruption unfold in this country in real time, political corruption, economic corruption. And I think that this country has been so ripped apart. And I think part of it is by the spread of misinformation. It's not wanting to understand that we are living through a global migration crisis where things like climate change and corruption and economic inequality, this impacts everybody. And we can't harden our borders and pretend that this stuff doesn't affect us. We are both implicated and responsible for a lot of these things, but also then really experiencing the aftermath of that. So I think we need to take a hard look at what we're doing internally and figure out how to make some progress and think about, you know, comprehensive immigration reform, climate change work. I mean, climate change is not going away, regardless of what some people in this country think. And a border wall is not going to solve these issues. And we're seeing climate change happen in real time, whether that's the California wildfires, flooding in the deep south, the crazy snowstorms in other parts. I mean, we are being impacted by climate change in all kinds of different ways. And so we need to take that seriously because it's displacing people both internally and externally. And that is the thing that this next generation, I think, is really going to have to deal with.
So as an anthropologist, you look at popular culture in a certain way. You've been trained to do this. Does it seem to you that we have created popular culture that has demonized Mexico? Call of Duty, where you run through a border town and you're shooting things up, or so-called reality TV shows about the border. And are we conditioning people to fear this in order to bring about these types of laws?
100%. I mean, it's so much fear-mongering. And I think that one of the things that I've really kind of noticed over the 20 years of doing this work is that the farther you get away from the U.S.-Mexico border, the stronger the opinion becomes about what's actually happening there. And I think and the level of ignorance seems to just rise and rise, because all people are doing is getting whatever media outlet that they focus on is telling them. And the issues are way more complicated. And I think that, we demonize Mexico in so many ways. And it's incredibly upsetting for many reasons. But also, I think it's doing real damage to our understanding about the way that the world works and our relationship with other countries. I mean, we have an education problem in this country about how the global economy works, about what's really happening, in relationship to climate change and to displacement and to refugees. And so we need to do a lot of soul searching, I think, internally.
So Texas Governor Greg Abbott, he recently had a press conference on the border where he said there were rape trees and that this is where smugglers will rape their smuggling victims at these rape trees, and then they will hang their garments from these trees. But he didn't have any evidence. There's no documentation. Rape is a crime. There's no investigation into whether or not this is actually happening, because it's happening on Texas soil. Do you know anything about rape trees? Is that a thing?
That's a right-wing conspiracy theory that that's been circulating for almost 20 years now. I can tell you this, when I was in doing work with migrants in northern Mexico starting around 2009, I was showing people pictures of these things that were circulating on the internet, and not one person in the hundreds of people that I talked to had ever seen one of those things. And so, you know, obviously this like striking kind of violent image that is a total distraction from everything else. I mean, people talk about sexual assault along the U.S.-Mexico border against migrants. We should be looking at the Border Patrol. I mean, the number of sexual assaults committed by Border Patrol agents, you know, is astronomical. And we never hear anything about that. And those crimes are not prosecuted, or at least not in any real way.
Do you get any pushback from people? I mean, you're a heretic talking about what's happening on the border. This is a version of events that does not sync up with what we've been hearing from Donald Trump and the people who are now in power.
Yeah, I mean, just because they don't like what I say doesn't mean it's not true. And, you know, I refuse to, I mean, my job as an anthropologist is to help people understand the way that the world is, the way that it looks, and hopes that we can create understanding, and through understanding, we can create empathy. And so all I can tell people really at the end of the day is, these are the things that I have seen with my own eyes. These are the things that I have experienced and written about. And I want you to understand these things. I want you to have a more nuanced understanding of what is happening at the U.S.-Mexico border, so that then we can make real change and understand the realities of what's actually occurring. But, you know, reality these days seems to be in short supply.
Yeah, reality is not in vogue right now. But I mean, I've been reporting on this stuff myself for 40 years. It still doesn't seem to penetrate.
No, I mean, this is the thing. It's like, it gets really frustrating where I just want people to understand some of the basics of what's going on and, you know, like why people migrate, you know, who's employing them here. These are really basic kind of concepts that we oftentimes refuse to accept or understand. And it's that refusal, I think, that creates these blockades, which is why you can stand in front of a group of people and say in Michigan and say, we're going to build a big, beautiful wall to keep Mexico from stealing your jobs. That is a total, I mean, that's a fantasy, but people buy into it. And it's an easier fantasy than trying to understand the complexities of the world that might call into question their own perspectives.
Jason De Leon, a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles, executive director of the Undocumented Migration Project. His new book, Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. Jason, thank you for talking to us today.
Dave, thank you so much for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you.